Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm thrilled to have Taylor Petrie and Eric Huntsman on with me today. Both are veterans of the podcast. Both are favorites of our listeners. Taylor brings a background in early church history, Eric in scripture and things like that, and teaches at BYU and especially the New Testament. And I just thought it would be good at the beginning of this Sunday school cycle to throw out a podcast that just does a good framing that can kind of set the tone for the year as we approach the New Testament. I think most of the people who listen to this podcast are aware that scholarship on the New Testament doesn't always match up, and the conclusions of scholars and things like that doesn't always match up with sort of the simplistic view of Scripture that we sometimes meet. And so I thought I would bring these guys on today to talk specifically about the Gospels, the world of the early church, and just kind of give us a feel for it. Later, as we get closer to Paul, we'll do another episode where we'll also bring on Tom Waymont, and he'll join our little team, and we'll talk about Paul and kind of get a feel for that. So just for right now, I wanted to start with these guys. Taylor, I think you've been on at least one more time than Eric. Would you reintroduce yourself to everybody about what you do?
Sure. My name's Taylor Petrie. I'm an assistant professor of religion at Kalamazoo College. I teach biblical studies, Jewish studies, and in the Women, Gender, and Sexuality program here at Kalamazoo.
Awesome. Thanks for coming back on the show, brother.
Glad to be here.
Eric Huntsman, you were on the show with Jared Anderson and me, and I think it was Lindsay Hansen Park, and we talked about the historical Jesus and kind of what is scholarship saying there and how to kind of frame the things we're learning. Welcome back to talk about the Gospels. Would you tell everybody about your background and what you do?
Sure. Thanks, Dan, for having me. I'm a lapsed Roman historian. Got my PhD in ancient history from Penn, and my first 9 years at BYU, I was actually in classics.
Oh, nice.
I came over to teach religious education in 2003. So I'm associate professor of ancient scripture, and I'm currently coordinating the Ancient Near Eastern Studies program here at BYU, which is the closest thing we actually have to biblical studies here. Religious education is, of course, religious education, but in our ANES program, we have a track in Hebrew Bible and another track in Greek New Testament. So it's where we try to prepare our students with the linguistic and the historical and the exegetical skills to study the Bible in more of an academic fashion.
Well, wonderful. Thanks so much for being on and being willing. You guys are both really busy. We're catching in the middle of the day. And for those, yeah, Eric's got a little bit of an ambient noise when he's on, so please excuse that a little bit, everybody.
It's the rushing of the spirit.
Oh man, you know, it always is silent for me. But anyway, that's awesome, man. The BYU is a special place, people. Anyway, hey, I'm thrilled to have you guys on to just kind of, I don't know that we'll be breaking tons of new ground today, but I think it's just that good reminder of some things, and especially after we kind of, you know, introduce the Gospels, who we think wrote them, dates, kinds of descriptions of them and things like that, I want to kind of move into faith and scholarship questions and knowing a little bit more how do we negotiate a new relationship with Scripture, because I think that's what happens. You know, we go from naive views, we go from the idea of privileged texts that you practically, you know, it's not fair to bring scholarship to those, and yet once that door's been opened, you know, there's a negotiation of things that has to go on. I am going to start with you, Taylor, if you wouldn't mind. Would you situate Jesus a little bit within the political situation of his day, just to kind of get us started. What was the nature of the people and the community that Christ ministered to and that formed the earliest church?
Okay, that's a lot to get in just a couple of minutes here. But in general, I guess I would say that there are two major historical contexts that are interrelated to be aware of. The first is sort of the broader, I guess, more global political context of Christianity, and specifically Jesus emerging in the context of the Roman Empire, the ancient Right. Roman Empire. And it's really in the the second and third generation of that empire too. So it's a relatively new concept for people in Judea to be governed by the Romans. And that's the second, maybe more minor political context to be aware of, is that the Romans had come to take control of Judea in the 60s BCE. Then kind of turned it over to Herod the Great as a kind of vassal king for a while. But after Herod died, around the time that Jesus was born, there was a kind of direct control of the Roman Empire in Judea, and specifically over the temple as well. They sort of had local governors and local leaders, specifically the chief priest of the temple, that would administer some of the affairs on their behalf. But for the most part, they were directly controlling that territory. And that lasted more or less off and on, I guess, for about 60 years, ultimately culminating in the first Jewish war at the end of the 7th century the 7th decade of the first century.
Can I jump in there for a moment, Taylor? I just wanted to, one of the things that your listeners may be interested in is, sometimes we look at this Roman imperialism, and there are certainly historical Jesus people like Richard Horsley who get really into this, but Roman administration, provincial administration, is never quite how people imagine it. Pilate was a very minor figure by Roman standards, had 2,500 auxiliary troops. It was a very loose occupation. Those of us who grew up showing our children Living Scripture videos, it just used to drive me crazy as a Roman historian. Each episode started out, the Romans ruled Judea with an iron hand. No, they were a very loose occupying force. And you have to understand, Taylor mentioned that the chief priest and the Jewish and religious officials were also civil officials. And the vast majority of things that were done in people's daily lives were still locally handled. Now, that's not to say that the elites, the local elites, were not exploiting the peasantry. That certainly is correct. But the interaction we will see later when we get to the Passion narrative is between Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin and Pilate really does reflect what a balancing act it was. And so you mustn't kind of imagine, Nazi-occupied France or something when you're thinking of Roman-occupied Judea. And as Taylor mentioned, it was mostly the temple and Jerusalem and Judea, Samaria, that was occupied as a province. But Galilee and Perea were run by Herod Antipas, who was a client ruler. And so he had a fair amount of autonomy. He was trying to negotiate keeping the Romans happy and keeping his own people in control. So this won't always impact people's study of the New Testament Gospels, but you just need to be aware that it is a very, very complex socioeconomic, political, religious equation. Sorry, Taylor, for jumping in there.
No, that's an excellent point to note. I think where I was going with it is that in part the Roman occupation and the Roman control of this territory, not necessarily in the political day-to-day realities, but the symbolic realities for many of the Judeans living in this territory at this time were quite significant. And so you do see riots erupting on occasions, and as I said, ultimately resulting in the first Jewish war, where the temple is destroyed, and the kind of symbolic tension that exists between Jews who expected an independent Israel and the realities of being governed, however remotely, I think, by the Romans, was a point of theological tension for many Jews, and in part where we need to understand messianic movements like early Christianity as being involved and situated in this symbolic context of Roman occupation.
Awesome. Now, that helps a little bit. So now we have a feel for so sometimes the characters that we'll encounter in the Gospels in the life of Jesus are going to be these Roman characters. We all hear about centurions. We know that that's the prophets. Tell us quickly about the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and any other like major players that are going to be political and religious kind of backdrops and people that are brought into the drama. Eric?
Well, I was interested, I was thinking as Taylor was talking about messianic expectations, for people who want to dig a little deeper, what they may want to do is actually back up about a century and a half and really look at what came before the Roman intervention in 63. So get a good book on the Hasmoneans, or you can find even something like The World Between the Testaments or something. But the so-called Maccabean Revolt against the Seleucids, the Greeks in Syria, did a lot to lay the groundwork, not only for the political situation, but these very groups you're mentioning, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, even the Essenes, because there had been a Jewish national movement to overthrow a Greek empire in Syria that had been controlling them and had tried to dominate the temple, desecrate the temple, some say, stamp out Judaism. And they had been successful over the course of a few generations in reestablishing an independent Jewish state. We call this the Hasmonean dynasty. Hasmonean is the family. Most people know them as the Maccabeans because one of the first ones was named Judas Maccabeus. Maccabeus meant the hammer. And this was a priestly family that led this national religious resistance to the Greeks. And little by little, they took the high priesthood, even though they weren't the right family. They weren't from a Zadokite family. And eventually even became kings as well, even though they weren't a Davidic family. So we have this period of about 100 years where there's an independent Jewish national entity ruled by a priest king, if you will. And if you think about that in Psalm 110 and all these expectations, there had actually been some savior figures that had been political and religious leaders that no doubt were an important factor in what people were expecting a Messiah to be. So a Messiah at the time of Jesus, they would expect to expel the Romans and the Herodian collaborators, much as the Hasmoneans had expelled the Seleucid Greeks. Now, in that period, the Hasmoneans were a priestly family, but as I said, they weren't the right one. There was some resistance early on to them. They had allied themselves with a group of devout Jews called the Hasidim, but once the Hasmoneans were in power, they bifurcated. There was a group who thought the Hasmoneans had become too worldly and they shouldn't have the priesthood and they certainly shouldn't be king, and so they completely withdrew, and we think that was the origins of the Essenes. While there was another group that didn't like the Hasmoneans, but they stayed within the Jewish culture, and we think they were the origins of the Pharisees. And likewise, a lot of the priestly aristocrats who were fine working with the Hasmoneans may well have been the origin of the Sadducees. So these groups that are prominent in the Gospels had their origins in the very period when some of these, maybe we shouldn't say false messianic expectations, but we would say mistimed, perhaps, messianic expectations came around. So as they're classically defined, the Pharisees are the ones who are purist, even though they are generally not priests. They try to live like priests. The idea was they're trying to keep the law so rigorously that they had lots of supplementary legislation to help them keep it. They believed in the oral tradition, the oral law of Moses. This is simplified, of course, and Taylor can correct me if I do this with too broad of a brushstroke. But the general idea is they were building a hedge about the law to help people keep it better. They believed not only in the Torah, the teaching or the five books ascribed to Moses, but the prophets and the writings. Whereas the Sadducees, who tended to be from the priestly aristocracy, only accepted the law, not necessarily the prophets. And because a lot of developments in Jewish beliefs about the afterlife and angels and resurrection seems to be at least exilic or post-exilic, the Sadducees didn't accept those things. So those are the two main groups that are referenced repeatedly
now,
in the Gospels. Please.
Let me interrupt real quick. Is it fair to say, though, that the Sadducees, because they were priests, had more of a temple-centered religion versus a law one? Okay, be careful. Okay.
Just remember that there are thousands and thousands of priests who only serve two courses or two shifts a year in the temple. It's the chief priestly families who are resident in Jerusalem and who control Jerusalem and the temple economy. You have to think the priestly aristocracy who are the Sadducees. Pharisees, yes, there were some upper-class Pharisees, members of the Sanhedrin, and they tended to actually push the high priest to do things their way, at least if you believe the Mishnah, later codification of these Jewish traditions. But the Pharisees did extend, middle class is not really an accurate term in antiquity, but they did extend into the villages and towns. And it's very interesting because the Pharisees Jesus interacts with in Galilee seem to be very much a different group than the aristocratic Pharisees you work with in Jerusalem. So the Pharisees tend to be a little bit more broadly based, to be sure, and they're not concerned specifically with the temple, but because the temple plays such a huge role in the law, yes, they were concerned with the temple too. So that's the only reason I hesitated to say Sadducees are temple and Pharisees are not.
Thank you.
Taylor, you want to clarify any of that for us, please?
There's absolutely nothing I want to clarify, but I'd add a few things that both of these groups, the ones that we know of as Sadducees and Pharisees in the New Testament, it's important to acknowledge them as really minority parties. The vast majority of Jews were really unaffiliated with either of these two groups, and so it's important to think of these as schools of thought and you know, certainly influential and politically powerful. But you know, one wasn't simply a Pharisee or a Sadducee as the only two options. Most people were just regular Jews trying to do the best that they could. And one of the other important things to kind of note about this is that among these groups, and Eric mentioned the Essenes as well, that this is really kind of the high point of Jewish sectarianism. So you get a lot of different competing understandings of what Judaism is, and we can multiply some of the other subtypes of Judaism that are developing during this time period and see Christianity and the early followers of Jesus as sort of emerging out of this context of sectarianism within Judaism. And part of that, this is then a period that is before the other really well-known Jewish group called the rabbis. And the rabbis don't really develop until really the end of the first and mostly in the second century and the early rabbinic period. And so it's also just important to kind of think about that most of what we know about Judaism today as a derivative of rabbinic Judaism hasn't fully come into development at the time of the time of Jesus and the writing of the New Testament.
Awesome.
Those were great points. I'm glad Taylor brought that up, particularly about the Sadducees, Pharisees, and other sectarian groups being minority, because looking at this through a New Testament lens, I mean, think of the vast number of people who were, you know, like Uncle Jack and Aunt Bertha from Payson. You know, they just, you know, they know the gospel's true and they go to church and they try to keep the commandments, but they may not be experts of the scripture and certainly don't know the details of theology. I mean, the average Galilean peasant would probably keep the festivals and knew the basic laws he or she was supposed to keep. But these are the very people that responded to Jesus, you know, whereas these others are opposed to him. Or even in an urban setting, when Jesus goes to Jerusalem in his final week, every time he kind of faces the Pharisees or the Sadducees in a temple dispute, you know, Luke will mention, and the people rejoiced. So, you know, you have to imagine these crowds who are very much for a populist kind of preacher that could just tell them how to live good lives. And remember that certainly the Sadducees and some of the upper class Pharisees, I mentioned this in the context of, you know, Roman and local elites. These were elites who tended to oppress the common people. And so even though they were forced to go to the temple and give their sacrifice to these chief priests, didn't mean they liked them.
Oh, nice.
And one other thing I thought about as Taylor was talking about this being the high point of sectarianism, this isn't something we, I think, readily identify with. Sure, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of different Christian churches, but they don't all go to our temple. And so you have these different ways of practicing Judaism, but they still, with the exception of the Essenes who withdrew completely, you have these people who are still coming and offering the same types of sacrifices in the same temple. So you could be a Pharisee or a Sadducee or one of these other groups or unaffiliated. And so it's a slightly different religious model than I think we tend to impose upon this as we read the text.
Nice. All that is really helpful. I think that will show up and add some flavor to our readings. Tell me this now. So this fellow, Jesus, he would have been known as Yeshua Bar-Joseph, would that be it, the Christ? Basically,
Joseph, not Joseph, I guess. If you're gonna start,
oh yeah, that's right. Okay. So we know his name is basically the equivalent of what we would now call Joshua, and then the Bar Joseph would mean son of Joseph. That also kind of helps a little bit. He would have grown up speaking primarily Aramaic, and that would be the Bar Joseph would be that. When you get into Ben Joseph or something, that's when you switch into Hebrew.
Dan, you know, if Jared were here, I think he'd make this point, so I'll speak for our absent friend. It is interesting. I don't think we have many texts. I mean, they say once or twice, isn't this the son of Joseph? But he also is called the son of Mary, which may raise some questions about legitimacy. And the thing I've heard Jared say before is a lot of these people who aren't from elite families sometimes are identified by place.
Jesus
of Nazareth. Now, that's right. Still open to debate what all that means. But, you know, to a lot of people, he would just be, hey, that guy from Nazareth.
Okay. So, yeah, that's good. That's certainly
Nathaniel. This is always a question with history, right, is most texts are written by elites. And so we know very much how elites are named and referred to. But we don't always know how commoners are. Nice, would that be fair, Taylor?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in fact, actually, some of the New Testament is some of our best evidence for how commoners referred to themselves. And it was not necessarily by their father. It was Simon, who is called Peter, or Jesus, who is called so-and-so. And so we've got these kinds of double names a lot. And it's not necessarily that the father's name is considered a kind of last name all the time.
Nice. And actually, I was really more going for anything. I just wanted to introduce the languages that are at play. But Aramaic as the common thing. And Aramaic has its roots in what other languages? Like, what's it most closely related to?
Well, Hebrew. I mean, it's the kind of language family of Semitic languages that are from this region. You've got Hebrew and Syriac and Aramaic. And Aramaic is kind of the more commonly spoken language, I guess, that you would see in this region at this time period, but it was really kind of a polyglot place too. You've got, you know, Roman soldiers there, so probably people knew enough Latin to get by, and of course Alexander the Great's conquest had made this a Greek-speaking region for centuries as well. So it's really, you can find any and every language there that you want to.
The Greek really is the wild card on this, because we know, because of, as Taylor mentioned, after Alexander the Great, at least in the Eastern Mediterranean, the upper classes tended to be quite Hellenized, and this is true even for the Jewish aristocracy. I mean, we have ossuaries that have Aramaic on them, but we have just as many that have Greek. So we know the upper classes were conversant, if not fluent, in Greek. The wild card here is what about the merchants and the business classes? You know, you can go to Nepal and people can speak what I call marketplace English. They can tell you it costs $2. You know, so fishermen in the Galilee, if they were selling fish, if they took them out to Phoenicia, would they know a little Greek? There's this interesting question that some of Jesus' disciples have Greek names. Now, Simon, of course, is different. He's Shimon, and he gets the names Cephas or Petros in Greek. But his brother is always known as Andrew. Andreas, which is a Greek name for Mr. Manly. Right. And they have a friend, Philippus, which means I love horses. So, I mean, we have some of the Galilean disciples who have Greek names. Interestingly, Bethsaida seems to have been a Jewish town, but Philip, Herod Antipas's brother, had refounded it as a Greek city. So, and they were two fairly Hellenized Greek-Jewish communities in Galilee, Sepphoris and Tiberias. Interestingly enough, Jesus never goes to those. The two biggest cities in Galilee, he never goes to. Sepphoris is just over the hill about 6 miles from Nazareth. And Tiberias is what, Taylor, maybe the same amount of miles from Capernaum.
Yeah.
So there's, as Taylor's exactly correct, it's very cosmopolitan and very polyglot.
Awesome. Now, and then Hebrew, though, would come in mostly in the formal temple settings and rituals?
Well, we don't know exactly how involved, you know, really how present synagogues and synagogue services were. Taylor's mentioned a lot of this develops in the rabbinic period. But the pattern seems to have been to read the scrolls in Hebrew, but because most people didn't know it, they would then have to explain it or interpret for them in Aramaic. And we may actually see something like that going on in Luke 4, famous scene when Jesus goes into Nazareth and then reads from Isaiah and then sits down to explain it. I mean,
oh, yeah, I remember that.
There may be something, Taylor, you can speak to this better than I can, but it may very much have been in this beginning pattern where the texts were written in Hebrew, but most people didn't understand them, so they had to be explained in Aramaic or whatever the vernacular was.
Awesome. So I guess what I'm saying is Jesus probably would have known some of all these languages. Sounds like he mostly would have done his preaching and things in Aramaic, but it seems clear from that Luke 4 passage that he knew some Hebrew.
And that he could read. I mean, this is still debated in historical Jesus studies. I mean, Craig Evans and conservatives would say, yes, this is proof that he can read. But most people couldn't. So did, you know, these small town people, Mary and Joseph, go out of their way to see that he got taught? Could he do it just because he happened to be God, in which case he could have read the Tale of Genji in Japanese on his own? I don't know the answer to that. But he's certainly portrayed in the later text as being able to read.
Awesome. Okay, well, and part of the reason for bringing up the languages here, and this is a focus this morning mostly on the Gospels, and it's in the Gospels that we see these interactions that we've been talking about with these different groups and whatnot. We have at least three of the four Gospels we know were written in Greek.
No, all four Gospels were written in Greek.
Oh, so Matthew is...
No, Matthew is most certainly written in Greek. Taylor, please jump in as soon as you want to. It is true that in some of the sayings of Jesus, we have Semiticisms, which would suggest that those sayings might have been in Aramaic and translated into Greek. But here we're falling into this overly simplistic view that Matthew is a Jew writing for the Jews when A, we don't know he's Matthew, and B, we don't know who he's writing to. Is that right, Taylor?
yeah, absolutely. There is a kind of old legend that it was originally written in Hebrew, dating from the early church, that Matthew was originally written in Hebrew, but there's really no evidence for that, and it's I would say 100% certain that it was not, because Matthew is using the Gospel of Mark, for instance, as a source for his own gospel, and he wouldn't have been translating it back from Greek into Hebrew, so it's definitely that Matthew is writing in Greek. I think that's almost 100% sure.
Yeah, Taylor, I don't have it in front of me. It's Irenaeus, isn't it, who said that he wrote to the Hebrews in their own language? But I think he also says it's the Logia, right? So I mean, it's conceivable he's saying that he wrote the sayings of Jesus in Aramaic or Hebrew. He's not necessarily saying that the gospel. I mean, we'd have to go and look at the text here. But there's certainly this sense that something about some of the Matthean material may have been in Aramaic or Hebrew. But it's clear, as Taylor says, that the text, the narrative text that we have, was written in Greek. Every single New Testament book was written in Greek. So let's establish that before we go any further in gospel doctrine.
Yeah.
Very good, very good. Okay, let's do who were the authors and the dating of them. Are you guys both holders to the Matthean primacy, the Markan, that Mark was the first gospel?
Seems to be. What do you think? Taylor, you agree with that, don't you?
I was going to hope that we are, yeah.
Yeah, well, in fact, Dan, why don't we just kind of start globally before we get into a gospel? Something that Latter-day Saint readers need to remember is that they have been spoiled by the Book of Mormon. You know, I mean, we are used to scriptures that say so-and-so wrote this at this time because, you know, so we know I, Nephi, am born of goodly parents, first year of the reign of King Zedekiah in Jerusalem because God told me so. All four gospels are formally anonymous.
Right.
Not a single one of them says, I, John, Jesus's best friend, writing for members of the church, you know. So they never state who wrote them.
Or their dates.
Or directly their audiences. These are things that must be gleaned from internal evidence clues and from later writings. The other thing to remind our listeners is anything that's not a verse is not original to the text, and not all the verses are original. So chapter headings, we know, are later insertions, but the titles on the books are later insertions. So, you know, it didn't start out Evangelion kata Markon. It was just a gospel. And it's not until we start to collect them in groups that we have to start identifying them. So let's maybe start with trying to establish how we came up with names at all for them, and then we can maybe talk about the order and the dating. Does that sound like a way to go, Peter, Taylor?
Yeah, and I think it might also be interesting to ask why four gospels, because there are other gospels. You don't need to have four gospels. Why do we get that tradition a little bit? That might be interesting to discuss too.
Go for it.
Well, is it because there are four winds and four cardinal directions? I'm sorry,
four
inside
elements.
Joke. Well, Irenaeus, who is a post-apostolic church leader, the Bishop of Lugdunum, writing in what, the mid-second century, when there are other gospels and they're trying to come up with a canonical list, he has to come up with a reason. And so he starts making these kind of analogies we wouldn't necessarily agree with. But Taylor's exactly right. I mean, we end up with four, and the naming of these gospels has a lot to do with trying to establish the validity or the authoritativeness of those particular texts.
Yeah, the earliest canon that we know of is from a mid-second century Christian guy who later is dubbed a heretic named Marcion, and he actually only has one gospel. He uses the Gospel of Luke, and his canon consists of many but not all of the letters of Paul that we know of today. And it seems to be somehow in response to this claim that there is only one gospel that we get the tradition of then having more than one gospel. And a second person that's relevant in this discussion is a guy named Tatian, who's writing a few decades after Marcion, who actually rewrites all four of the gospels into one big gospel and just harmonizes the whole thing. So it's just one text, so you're not reading the same story over and over and over again. And he calls this, or it gets called the Dia Tesseron, the four books that are put together here into one. And so it seems that early Christians in the second century are really kind of trying to experiment with which texts are authoritative and why. And we get different theories about which gospels should be counted and how they should be counted and so on. So that we have these four is not just a natural fact, but it is the process of a long debate.
Awesome. That's very helpful. Let's talk about the four that we do have. Do we want to do some broad characterizations of them first, or would you like to take them in terms of priority and who's dependent on who and, you know, all that kind of stuff?
Taylor, should we do Mark, Matthew, Luke, John in that order? Does that sound reasonable?
That sounds perfect.
Okay. Well, we suspect that Mark is the first gospel written for a number of reasons. Let's do the internal evidence first and then the external evidence after that. In terms of internal evidence, it's because the content of the Gospel of Mark is found, almost all of it, in Matthew and or Luke. So that's one of the factors that leads us to embrace what we call Markan priority, that Mark must have come first. Matthew in particular seems to be following Mark very carefully and correcting his grammar. I mean, that's another thing that helps us reinforce this idea of Markan priority. If Mark hasn't written something very elegantly in Greek or makes a grammatical error, Matthew will correct it. And I guess it's conceivable someone could be doing a Reader's Digest version of Matthew and make a grammatical mistake. But there are stylistic reasons that lead us to believe that Mark was written first and served as a source for Matthew and certainly for Luke, who sometimes has material that Matthew had left out from Mark.
Okay, and what's the earliest dating that scholars give for Mark versus, you know, the latest? What's the date ranges and what's the usual consensus?
Well, mid to late 60s, but that's mostly because of a later association of Mark with the figure of Peter. There's a second century writer named Papias. His work doesn't survive, but it's preserved in a quotation in Eusebius's Church History, who said something along the lines of, Mark, having been the interpreter of Peter, wrote accurately but not in order all the things that were said or done by the Lord, following Peter, who used to adapt his preaching to the needs of the moment. Now, that's a very kind of convoluted and pregnant passage. But early on, there was this association of this text with a guy named Mark, and we'll have to figure out who Mark is, who had some association with Peter, and because Peter traditionally was martyred in the 60s, the gospel couldn't have been before that.
Okay.
The only thing I would add to that is the way that aspects of the text in Mark seems to refer to some of the contemporary events or the soon to come to pass events of the first Roman war against the Jews in the late 60s also seems to suggest a dating in that proximity. So for instance, Mark chapter 13 is this kind of mini apocalypse chapter, which seems to refer pretty clearly to an attack on Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple there. Which of course happened in the next, I'm sorry, did I say the 60, in sometime in the 70s, I should say, the late 60s up until the year 70. So that's another kind of reason that people date Mark to around that time period.
Okay, so no matter what, though, he's some 30 years past Jesus, and he's, what, 10 to 15 years past Paul's active ministry?
Well, no, Paul is traditionally martyred in the early 60s as well. His death is associated with the Emperor Nero. But it is true that Paul's writings, at least the secure Pauline letters, are written in the 50s and early 60s. So Paul's letters do annotate any of the Gospels. So, for instance, if we were to look at the earliest account of the Last Supper, we would not look at Mark. We would look at 1 Corinthians 11.
Got it.
And that Paul, just to underline that point, Paul, that means that Paul never read any of these gospels, lived and died as a follower of Jesus without ever having read a single one of these gospels. That's a kind of a shocking point to think about.
Nice. So brief characterizations then. We don't know who Mark is. We have a little bit about this potential contemporary with Peter. And then what about Mark's, you know, a lot of people talk about it. It's fast moving. It's the sparsest one. And it does seem to be a text that sort of emphasizes, you know, either for theological reasons, for whatever, Jesus not really wanting people to think that he's claiming himself as the Son of God and things like that. Is that?
Yeah, let's hold off the messianic secret until after we've characterized Mark as a whole, because that
okay, please do. Okay,
Jesus issue.
Okay.
First of all, we mentioned that there are some post-apostolic sources that associate this text with a guy named Mark, and that fellow is associated with Peter. How did we end up with the particular Mark that by convention or by tradition we associate it? Well, there's a guy named John Mark in Acts. You see him in Acts 12, Acts 15. He's also referred to as a companion of Paul in Colossians and Timothy in Philemon. And once with Peter, if 1 Peter is a Petrine text. So there's a guy named John Mark, which is interesting because Johanan's a Jewish name, but Marcus is a Roman name. So you might have kind of a Saul-Paul situation, a Jew with Roman citizenship perhaps. One of the things that is interesting is who the presumed audience is. Now, once again, the text doesn't say who it is, but because of the association of Mark with Peter, who died in Rome, usually the assumption is that the gospel was a group of Christians in or around Rome, so primarily a Gentile church. Internal evidence in the text may support that. Mark's always anxious to explain Jewish customs. When he quotes an Aramaic word, he always translates it. There's an emphasis on persecution and endurance, which might fit a persecuted Christian minority in the capital. In terms of the fast movement pace, I don't remember the figure. Maybe Taylor's heard this before, but apparently this can be read aloud in Greek within the course of like 3.5 hours. So the idea is it's supposed to be something that could be heard in one sitting. I don't know that I'd read Isaiah for 3 hours, but I would probably read Mark.
I've actually seen it performed.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, it's kind of a neat thing to see.
But the idea is, of course, not literacy rates are low. I mean, they're higher among Greeks and Jews than other people, but Greek-speaking Jewish, Roman Christians, they could all read it, so they would hear it. And so it has to be a narrative that would be engaging, that you could follow. There are a lot of adverbs like quickly, straight away, next, a lot of use of historical present. But what's interesting, sorry, I've just been teaching, Mark, so this is on my mind. I characterize this as the Harry Potter gospel sometimes. You know, it's got to be something that's engaging. And so even though Mark's the shortest gospel, part of that is because he doesn't have long teachings of Jesus, with the exception perhaps of Mark 13, the Mark and Apocalypse. You have parables and short teaching sayings of Jesus. You don't have a 3-chapter Sermon on the Mount. So Matthew is much longer than Mark, to be sure, but a lot of that's because of the addition of new discourse material. But when it comes to describing an action, and particularly miracles, I've just finished a study on the miracles, Mark is sometimes 2 or 3 times more fulsome in describing a miracle than Matthew is. So the story of the Gadarene demonic, the guy with this legion of devils, is something like, you know, 6 or 7 verses in Matthew, but it's 20-some verses in Mark. So as long as what he's talking about is an action, particularly about Jesus doing something powerful, then he's quite descriptive. I also sometimes characterize this as the John Wayne Jesus. Jesus is very much a good man, to be sure, and he's the Son of God because God said so at the baptism and on the Mount of Transfiguration. But he's a very human Jesus. He's a little rough. He gets angry. He gets frustrated with his disciples. And so it's always an interesting thing to read Mark on its own and not let it be colored by your preconceived notions of Jesus from the other Gospels.
I agree.
In part, I would just add that some of the way of thinking about the way that Mark is structured also has to do with, yes, Mark is the first gospel to be written, but he is most certainly relying on earlier written sources that he's using. And these seem to be collected in chains, as they're sometimes referred to, where you get a miracle story, miracle story, miracle story, miracle story, and then you get parable, 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 parable. And the way that these are sort of bunched together, not in the kind of narrative context, and then he went here, and then he did this, and then he said this, but as a kind of collection of here's all of the miracle stories, here's all the parable stories, here's the controversy stories that are all bunched together. He seems to be taking these different stories and putting them into a narrative, somewhat clumsily probably, but that's in part, I think, what makes up the literary character of Mark is the reliance on his earlier written sources too.
Yeah, in fact, I've heard it described as kind of beads on a string. And so you have five round parable beads, and you have four chunky miracle beads. And but what's interesting, remember I mentioned that early source Papias, who said that he wrote accurately but not in order. And that was Papias' attempt to say, this is trustworthy material, but we all know it's not in a at least chronological order. And that's important for understanding the structure of Mark, because Mark looks like it's in a geographic order, but that's clearly thematic. It starts out with the largest section, the first act, if you will, which is the authoritative ministry in Galilee, and then a short central act, the road to Jerusalem, which is where the passion predictions come, and we can come back to that idea of messianic secret connection with that if you want, Dan. And then you have the third act, the climax in Jerusalem. Mark, Matthew, and Luke only have Jesus go to Jerusalem once, something which is completely missed by people who are used to harmonizing the Gospels. Because the Gospel of John has Jesus going back and forth to Jerusalem for every festival. People get this three-year ministry in their minds because of three Passovers. And yet what you have in Mark is this idea that everything about Jesus is heading for the cross. So his whole ministry is leading up to Jerusalem once, where he will suffer, die, and then maybe rise again, depending upon how you do Mark 16. And so it's as much a thematic progression as it is a geographic, but it's certainly not a chronological. Partly that can be explained, as Taylor suggested, because of this clumping of material. But I think it's also is a narrative issue on Mark's part that he's organizing the gospel globally, probably following the pattern of apostolic teaching, right? Peter's speeches, at least as Luke portrays them in Acts, always have this pattern. God sent his son Jesus, who went about doing good. He suffered, he died, he rose again.
Nice. Now, Taylor, you mentioned something there, Mark looking at his sources, and that's perhaps why the clumps there. Should we mention Q, as the what scholars sort of believe is there's a saying source?
Not till we get to Matthew and Luke.
Yeah.
So Q is not involved with Mark at all?
Nope.
Okay, I guess I was under the wrong impression there. Is Burton Mack on? I believe that's what he argues, that Mark kind of combines, Paul for the theology, some Q source material, and kind of a Roman, hero dramas, and kind of creates Jesus in sort of he's the one that turns Jesus into this, the figure that the others sort of buy into.
I can't speak. I haven't read Mack in a long, long time, but I would be pretty surprised if he said that Mark was reliant on
Q. Okay. And I think that's the part too, because I took a class from him back in 89, and Mark, Myth of Innocence, had just come out, and he was blowing me away left and right, and I know he later did a lot of work on Q, so maybe I was conflating those things, but...
He's an incredibly influential scholar from that era, and... But Myth of Innocence is absolutely worth reading. But
Q isn't involved. Okay, sounds good. Cool. All right, and we'll get to Q there. So what else do we want to say about Mark? Is it time for the Messianic Secret, or is there anything? Well, there's the controversy about where the book ends,
right.
What's a later edition. Should we quickly do that?
But maybe before we say where it ends, let's start with where it begins.
Nice.
It is important to mention that there is no birth story or any account of Jesus' childhood at all. It opens with John the Baptist. And if Mark knew that Jesus was born from a virgin in a miraculous way, he didn't think it was worth mentioning. And so the absence of the birth story there sets up the some of the comparisons that we can then make with Matthew and Luke later on. But it's important to really emphasize and underline that Mark doesn't include any account of Jesus's miraculous birth.
Now,
in fact, in Mark, Jesus is God's son because God says so, and that's it.
Right.
So at the baptism, the voice of God, the heavens are ripped apart. The King James makes it a little too subtle. The heavens are ripped open, and the voice of God says, "Thou art my beloved son." People only think of the Matthew, "This is my beloved son," but Mark and Luke both have the divine pronouncement to Jesus. So it's pretty much like Psalm 2, "This day I have begotten thee." And then that divine proclamation is demonstrated by the authoritative teaching, and particularly the deeds of power that Jesus demonstrates. And then on Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John hear the voice of God say, "Thou art my beloved son," of Jesus in that instance. This is what some people call adoptionist Christology, and they think that perhaps early Christians thought Jesus was God's son in the sense that God adopted him. or proclaimed him his son. We don't necessarily have to embrace that, but that certainly could be argued from the way Mark is set up.
Yeah, to emphasize that issue about the calling Jesus God's son is not would not necessarily have been understood by ancient Jews or Greeks as indicating anything about his biological parentage. It was a title that was given, we know, to a number of kings in ancient Israel. The Roman emperor, was called the son of God. This was not necessarily something that had to do with how he was conceived or how he was born. We'll have some time to think about all of the other titles that Jesus gains and collects along the way, including Christ, including the Messiah. But just think about that issue of the Son of God is not necessarily one about the birth story itself. And as I think Eric rightly emphasizes it, we're introduced to that term at the baptism story of Jesus in Mark.
Nice. And in fact, I was going for where you guys took us. But one quick thing, isn't there some sense, or is it really clear from the text that this was an open declaration of God versus just an internal vision to Jesus at the baptism, that thou art my son, or this is my beloved son? Is it pretty widely recognized that from the structures or something anybody present would have heard this?
No, even reading it in the King James, not doing another translation, looking at the Greek, I mean, it simply says, straightway coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens.
Right, that's how I always looked
like
at it.
And the Spirit descended upon him, and there came a voice from heaven saying, thou art my beloved son, whom I was well pleased. So there's no indication in this account that anyone else would have heard it.
Okay, but
doesn't mean they couldn't have. I mean, this, right. These kind of things don't determine what happened historically. It's simply saying how a text is representing it.
Right, and that's why I was asking that, because Mark says, you're basically saying Mark's picked up this as the indication because God said so, but yet Mark in some ways is the first one to say that Jesus had this vision that said so, that told him in his own head or in his own spiritual state. Does that make sense?
He doesn't depict it as something that's in his head necessarily, but there is no evidence in the text to suggest that anyone else perceives this vision, this account, or hears these things in this account. Matthew changes it slightly, and Luke changes it slightly. Luke seems to have the vision seen not even at the baptism itself. It's after the baptism when Jesus is praying. The location is not specified there, but it's really only Matthew that has it as a kind of public declaration. Mark seems to be, as Eric rightly reads it, as a private vision.
Yeah, and that's how I always read it too. When you get to John and you get a little John the Baptist and he's explaining those who called me to the Spirit or whatever, the angels that called me to do this, told me when I'd see the sign of the dove, I would know that this is the one, who I'm making way for. And so at least that's where I've picked up, at least somewhere through the years, that's perhaps that John the Baptist was at least folded into part of this vision. Does that make any sense or not?
That one's in John. That version is in the Gospel of John.
Right, that's what I said.
But yeah.
And instantly, John doesn't actually mention the baptism, right? We read that into it. So.
Right.
Oh, gotcha.
There's baptism in John at all, exactly.
That's when he's talking to his disciples.
Stop harmonizing, Dan.
I just remember that, though, because he says, when I see the sign of the dove, and so.
Yeah. It makes sense, but once again.
Yeah, it's not right there. Exactly there. Good. Good call.
We still have three other Gospels to go, so maybe we can treat Messianic Secret and the ending of Mark real quickly and then move along. Messianic Secret is this idea that Jesus either didn't think he was the Messiah, which of course I personally do not believe, or that he didn't want people to know. And it's based on passages or experiences such as when Jesus heals someone and says, tell no man of this.
Right.
Or when he comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration, don't tell anybody about this. And to be sure, in that first act of Mark, so Mark 1 through beginning of 8, you certainly see that pattern, but it's not consistent. For instance, the Gadarene demonic, when he cast the devils out of the Gadarene demonic, and the Gadarene demonic wants to follow him, he says, no, you need to go home. You can't be one of my disciples right now. You need to go home and tell your friends and your townsmen and everyone the great things God has done for you. So one fairly convincing argument to me is that with Jews on the western side of Galilee, he tended to be circumspect. But the Gadarene Demonic happened in the Decapolis on the eastern side. He wasn't. Now, is this a historical thing, or is this something in terms of the Markan audience? If Mark was, in fact, written to a Roman audience, this persecuted Christian community was supposed to be faithful and evangelize. And so this Gadarene Demonic might actually be serving as a type of the Roman Christian community who's supposed to go out and preach the gospel. That's one possibility. But I think it's also possible historically, because of these false or mistimed messianic expectations, we know from John 6 that when Jesus does the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, they want to make him a king. Or every time Jesus performs a miracle, he is swamped with faith healing requests, and he can't preach. So one possible way of tempering the messianic secret is Jesus didn't want people to focus on what he was eventually going to do or his miracles. He wanted to preach the good news of the kingdom. So with Jews, he was restrained, and with Gentiles, he might have been more open. But the messianic secret thing starts to dissipate with the first use of the term Christ in the Gospel of Mark, with the exception of Mark 1:1, which is probably a title. This is the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ. We don't have anyone refer to Jesus as Christ until Peter's declaration in Mark 8:29. This is when in Caesarea Philippi he says, "Who do you say I am?" And Peter says, "Thou art the Christ." So, but even then his understanding is incomplete, right? Three times in this second act on the road to Jerusalem, Jesus will say, the Son of Man is going to Jerusalem. He will be betrayed, suffered, die, rise again. And his disciples just can't get their minds around that. They may now be coming to this understanding that in some sense he's the Messiah, the Christ, but they have no soteriological understanding that he's coming to suffer, die, and rise again. And so we're going from no talk of Jesus as Messiah to misunderstood talk of Jesus as the Messiah. And the only people who get it at all are a few women at the end, the third act.
Great stuff.
It's an incredibly strange theme, and one to which there really isn't, I don't think, still a super convincing answer, because it's unique to Mark, as was mentioned, so much so that when Matthew and Luke rewrite Mark for their own Gospels, they edit it out entirely. They don't depict the disciples as unknowing or unaware. And there are so many strange instances of the disciples not understanding things, where even Jesus in the text gets exasperated with them. Not once, but twice he performs this feeding of the multitudes miracle, and they still seem to be confused when they're on the boat later about whether or not it's possible for Jesus to provide food. They seem confused by this possibility, and Jesus gets kind of annoyed with them. I think it's more, if we were to think about what the meaning is, I think that it has less to do with telling us anything about what Jesus was like historically or what his disciples were like, and seems to serve a kind of literary function for Matthew, because it's clear that as readers, as Eric notes, as readers, we are told right at the very beginning who Jesus is. We know who Jesus is, but the disciples don't seem to throughout the text. And it is a kind of strange, sort of mysterious theme. And yeah, it's evident that Mark and Luke didn't like it either, so they got rid of it for whatever reason.
Awesome. Okay, just quickly, just orient people to the controversies over the ending, or I don't even know if it's controversial. It's pretty much the dominant thought, right, about Mark not having additional verses added on.
Well, this is the so-called long verse short ending of Mark, and the reason for this is in the oldest and best manuscripts, Greek manuscripts of the Gospel of Mark, the last verse is chapter 16, verse 8. And in later manuscripts, there is a cobbled together ending, verses 9 through 20, which clearly is coming from Matthean and Lucan material, and a little Johannine material for that matter. So clearly scribes are trying to finish the story based on what they know.
It felt like it was too abrupt, yeah.
Yeah, but to a certain extent, since most of it's Matthean and Lucan material, it might have had its origins in Mark anyway. But while it is true that the short ending is the more probable ending of our earliest manuscripts, that doesn't necessarily mean that was the original ending of the autograph of Mark's or the second evangelist text, right? I mean, it's possible that the original ending was lost, and so scribes are just trying to reconstruct it. But just to give readers and listeners a sense of what we're reading, you have the women come to the tomb, and they find the stone gone, and you have a young man say, you look for Jesus, he's not here, go tell Peter and the disciples. And the last verse is these women running away screaming and scared, and they don't do what they're told, and you're just kind of left like, is he alive, is he not, are they going to do it, are they not? And you know, there are ways you can say this has a literary purpose.
I've heard that, yeah. That people like,
what is our response to the story of the empty tomb? Are we going to be scared by it? Are we going to go forth in faith? But Ben Witherington, and of course he's conservative, but he tries to make the argument that at chief places in this gospel, there's always something eschatological. So you have the ripping open of the heavens at the baptism, at the transfiguration, at the crucifixion. And so he really wants an eschatological ascension or something at the end, which of course is not there. But there is a grammatical problem. Taylor, I don't have the text in front of me, but doesn't it end with a gar? And you don't, the Greek, something looks wrong in the Greek in verse 8. I mean, it's not a definitive argument against the short ending, but it is an argument that some make.
I don't recall that specific thing. I guess I could look it up here too. But yeah, the dominant understanding is that, at least according to the best text that we have, is exactly as Eric said, that it ends at the end of 16, verse 8. And then there are actually a couple of different endings that we get, a longer one and a shorter one that seem to be added on at another time. So whatever the ending was, I think the message that we get is that it was something that was fungible, right? It was something that people were experimenting with different endings, not just even if the it doesn't exactly end at 16:8. We know that people are adding on at least two other different kinds of endings to it, the longer and the shorter. So it seems to be something that people are still working on, developing the text and finishing off this story of Jesus's resurrection.
Nice. Thank you. Tell us who Matthew is. Situate Matthew for us.
All Gospels are formally anonymous, Dan.
That's right. That's right. I caught it before you even said that. See?
Well, I guess I can start here. So Matthew, and we'll maybe go a little quicker on Matthew than we did on the other ones. Matthew is using Mark as a source, but he also has other sources. So he greatly expands Mark. And reorganizes some of the way that Mark had written the text. There are two major things that Matthew adds to Mark. Number one is the birth story, and we get for the first time an account of Jesus's miraculous birth. And the second thing that he adds are a number of teachings or sayings of Jesus which Mark doesn't have. And we had talked a little bit earlier that the term that is used to describe and categorize these particular sayings of Jesus is called Q, from the German word Quelle, meaning source. It just is a sort of nickname that source text has gotten.
When it's not a member of the continuum in the next generation.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, man, geek.
See, we're geeky at BYU.
So with these two major additions, then Matthew really kind of tells a slightly different story for who Jesus is. We mentioned already that he gets rid of this messianic secret, and he seems to have a different understanding of the proclamation of a royal Messiah along the way. So there are a handful of other things that Matthew adds to the text to kind of shape who he understands Jesus to be, but. I'll maybe pause there and let Eric jump in.
Yeah, I'd actually like to go back to the identification of the author for a moment. You know, when I'm taking my students through this, it's a little unsettling, I guess, sometimes for BYU students to take this approach, but I always say, let's go through the internal evidence, the external evidence, and then explain why, you know, conventional identification is okay. You know, I don't say the conventional identification is right, but it may be right. And so if you look at, once again, internal evidence, there is no direct evidence. The author doesn't identify himself, but there are some indirect clues to the kind of person he was. As we mentioned at the outset, it was written in Greek, not Aramaic. So it's someone who knows Greek and knows it better than Mark, for that matter. It seems clear the author is a conservative-minded Jew. He certainly uses the Hebrew Bible a lot.
Yeah.
And not just the Septuagint. Some of his quotations of the Bible are from the Septuagint, but some seem to be his own translations from the Hebrew. So this is someone who knew the Hebrew Bible and could translate it to Greek and read it in Greek. He knows Jewish text and the law very well, which is interesting because we usually associate him with a tax collector who may or may not have been a scribe, but that's not what you would expect, right? We don't expect IRS agents to be rabbis, but I mean, I guess they can be. Sometimes people like to see an autobiographical reference. In chapter 13, there's a collection of these parables, and there's a single verse parable. Every scribe which is instructed in the kingdom of heaven is like a man who's a householder who brings forth his treasures new and old. And some have seen this author's interest in the old text and the prophecies as being the old treasures, but he is going to take that and match it, in fact, outstrip it with the new treasures, the words of Jesus. Now, in terms of external evidence, we get the identification with a figure named Matthew, once again, from post-apostolic writers. Papias said that after Mark, Matthew compiled the sayings, the logia, in the Hebrew language. I made the argument earlier that maybe he has a collection of the sayings in Aramaic and is going to translate them into Greek. Irenaeus used the name Matthew. Later, Clement as well uses the name Matthew. So that's where the name Matthew comes from. And later, that's identified with one of the 12, whom, you know, the tax collectors, Levi and Mark and Luke. But here we have the disciple named Matthew being the tax collector. So that's the association, the traditional association. Did you want to say anything about authorship before I say a few things about the character of the text, Taylor?
Nope, go ahead.
I'm very interested, and not everyone holds to this structure of it, but because I am interested in that kind of issue of the treasures old and new, Taylor's mentioned that the addition of the infancy narrative, Matthew 1 through 2 at the beginning, is the opening slice of bread, if you will, that we didn't have in Mark. And the closing slice of bread, of course, will be the Passion Resurrection narrative. But the body of Matthew, even though it's roughly following the order of Mark, is organized differently. Taylor was mentioning this discourse material that we usually attribute to a source Q. A lot of it is organized into five big sermons, the Sermon on the Mount being, of course, the most prominent one, Matthew 5 through 7. But these sermons break up the narrative section of the text into five sections. So you have a section, chapters 3 and 4, followed by the Sermon on the Mount, 5 through 7. You have a section of narrative, chapters 8 and 9. Then you have a sermon, the mission sermon, chapter 10. Opposition to Jesus, 11 and 12. The sermon in parables in 13. Rejection of Jesus, 13 through 17. Then the sermon of the church in 18. And then finally, journey to Jerusalem. And then you've got the eschatological sermon in 24, 25. What this does is it breaks the body of the text into five parts. And it's very tempting to make an analogy between the five parts of Matthew with the five books traditionally ascribed to Moses. So you have the old law, if you will, the written Torah, and now you have the new words of Christ organized into five sections or books. Not everyone agrees with that, but it certainly is divided into five, and I think that's interesting.
It does point to, we haven't quite mentioned this yet in terms of talking about the literary comparisons that both Mark and Matthew are making for Jesus, is that Moses and to a certain extent Elijah and the prophets in general are kind of archetypes and prototypes, we could maybe even say, of Jesus in the Gospels. And so I don't think it's a total stretch to say that the way that Matthew is organizing his text is showing Jesus as a new Moses.
Well, yes, certainly. I mean, you've got Jesus going up on the hill like Moses went in the mountain.
Right.
And even in the infancy narrative, I mean, the whole killing the children of Bethlehem, Herod there is very much patterned after Pharaoh and that kind of thing. So,
right. So there are all these allusions and echoes to both Elijah and Moses, who are both, of course, establishers and reestablishers of Israel and the religion of Israel. And so Jesus as a kind of fulfillment of those types is part of the way that Jesus is framed in these texts.
For sure.
If I can just talk about miracles, Dan, I'm sorry I keep coming back to those, but
sure.
I described that Harry Potter gospel for Mark, that Mark kind of reveled in not only describing miracles, but he loves to have Jesus do things, spit on people, touch them, say abracadabra, or at least talitha kumi. Matthew does miracles very differently. It seems Taylor mentioned that Matthew and Luke are a little uncomfortable with this messianic secret. Matthew and Luke are also both uncomfortable with Jesus's miracles being misinterpreted as magic. So they remove a lot of the elements that might be misinterpreted as magical. So Mark might have thought, wow, this proves Jesus is really powerful. But Matthew and Luke want Jesus to perform miracles just because he's the Son of God. So they remove a lot of the actions. the use of saliva in miracles, which appears interestingly in John, but in a very different context. Exorcisms are handled in a very different way. And so what we see here is a self-consciousness in taking what even historical Jesus people who are critical say is part of the ministry of the man of Nazareth, that he was a faith healer and reputed to be an exorcist. That material was there, but they are very self-consciously treating it in a different way to make sure it's not misunderstood by their audiences as being too much like contemporary magic practice or Jewish exorcism, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a really important point to mention. And you know, you've just written on this, so I'm sure you can say a lot more about it too. But Jesus's miracles and his miraculous deeds, his healings, his exorcisms, and so on, would not necessarily have been something that no one else would have ever seen or done. We know of a lot of kind of traveling miracle workers from the ancient world, and Jesus seems to fit into that context. So the way in which I think you're absolutely right that Matthew is working on Mark's stories about these miracles to, in some ways, distance Jesus from some of these other miracle workers and magicians is a part of the context of what's going on when Jesus is doing these deeds.
Very cool. Now, quickly on audience, you mentioned certainly we think that this Matthew or whoever the author is Jewish, certain super familiar. There seems to be a lot of, using the Hebrew Bible as an attempt to kind of say, see, this is the Messiah. See, this is the fulfillment. Would you say that that's the driving purpose, or is that?
Well, you know, this is another example where we have to be careful and take the usual characterizations and nuance them a little bit.
Good. So, that's what this is for.
Yes, clearly the author is a Jewish Christian concerned with Jewish issues, and presumably his audience largely is as well. But that doesn't necessarily mean this is some kind of missionary tract and he's trying to convert Jews to Christianity. It may very well be trying to help Jewish Christians be stronger in their faith or understand better how this person they believe in was the Jewish Messiah. So that's one thing to be aware of. The other thing is, it's not true it's written solely to a Jewish audience, because there are important inclusions of Gentiles. A few LDS opinions notwithstanding, it's clear that historically and in art and in Christian tradition, and by the name Magi alone, that the wise men were Gentiles. And so, you know, you have even Gentiles are being brought to this Jesus. And then, of course, at the crucifixion, the first person to say this is the Son of God is the centurion at the foot of the cross. And so I think, and Taylor does this material better than I do, but I suspect that Matthew is writing for a mixed, maybe predominantly Jewish Christian audience, but we know that the Jewish Christian communities in Syria increasingly had Gentiles among their membership. And, you know, we'll see this in a minute with Luke. Luke, whom everyone feels confident is a Greek, writing primarily for a Greek or Hellenistic audience, is very interested in Jewish things. He talks about the temple more than anyone else, and he knows the Septuagint pretty well. And so I think we need to be careful about making these firm characterizations of authors and audiences.
I would totally agree with that. And I would say that one of the ways of understanding particularly these, what we call the fulfillment formulas, these citations of Hebrew prophecy as evidence of Jesus's divine status and so on, is less about maybe the intended audience or really anything about the author, but about, it tells us something about how early Christians begin to try and read the Hebrew Bible for evidence of Jesus's status and the kind of collections of texts and proof texts, I guess we could say, that are put forward in Matthew seems to reflect that practice. So I'm with Eric that I'm a little cautious about, you know, making definitive claims about who the audience is based on its use of the Hebrew Bible, but more about the way in which Matthew seems to be reflecting a contemporary concern among followers of Jesus of showing that Jesus is this kind of connected to and continuation of the prophecies that are made about him. And part of that has to do with the ways in which then the stories start to conform to the text themselves. So Matthew is a really great example of this, because he quotes the prophecy of Zechariah, of Jesus riding into Jerusalem, or the king, the Messiah, shall ride into Jerusalem on the back of a colt and on the back of an ass. And Matthew actually goes so far as to say, well, he was actually on writing both. Two animals. Yeah.
Yeah. I've always tried to picture how you surf with a foot on.
Well, Bart Ehrman makes a big deal with that.
Well, you know, it's actually quite striking error because, you know, we've said that this is a Jewish author well familiar with Jewish texts, and yet he doesn't understand parallelism. I mean, it is very striking, actually, unless perhaps – he is awkwardly trying to reproduce that parallelism in the story. I mean, it's unclear what's going on there.
There's a kind of hyper-literalism about the reading of the text that does it makes you giggle when you finally notice it. But that's why I'm less convinced that it's necessarily a story about who the audience is, because I think to a certain extent that Eric's point is right there too, that many Jews would have not understood that to be referring to two different animals when they read that text, right?
Right. Cool. Hey, let's transition into Luke with one quick thing. How far after Mark do you think Matthew was written, and then date Luke and start riffing on that?
Well, you know, that's hard to know, and Taylor may have the details better than I do, but one thing that people point to is that you have you know, this little apocalypse in Mark 13, Jesus' prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem. And in the Matthean version, it's much expanded with much more detail. So people have said that the author of the first gospel, with hindsight, seeing how that prophecy was realized, is filling in the gaps. So a lot of people would, I assume, date Matthew till some point after the destruction of the temple in 70.
Right, right.
So I usually tell my students, just for convenience sake, mid-70s, but it could be a little later. Clearly after Mark, whom we think is in mid to late 60s, so, you know, give yourself 10 years to write it.
Right.
It takes me that long to write things sometimes. So anyway, I don't know. Do you have a better dating on that, Taylor?
No, the conventional dating for these things is sometime around the year 75 to 85 for both Matthew and Luke.
Okay.
But there's no real hard and fast way of narrowing it down beyond that. So that tends to be, there's a sort of later dates in which we know people start to quote these things, but even those are several decades after the hypothesis of when they're written in the late 70s or early 80s. So sometime in that time period is about as clear as we can say.
Awesome. Okay. The Lucan author, and should we even mention Luke Acts as kind of the historical or the historian's way of referring to them almost as one piece?
Well, they very clearly were written as companion pieces because they are addressed to the same figure, whether that's an actual person or a type.
Theophilus, yeah.
Theophilus.
Lover of God.
And the sub-prologue, as I call it, the beginning of Acts, makes reference to the earlier
text.
I don't know that we want to go any farther with Acts.
Yeah, I don't think we need to, but we don't know who Luke is. We can do the same exercise we've done before.
We can look at internal evidence and external evidence. So once again, there's no direct internal evidence. The gospel's anonymous. Some early manuscripts have subscriptions, but they're no later than the end of the second century. But the internal indirect evidence is kind of interesting. The author makes very clear he was not an eyewitness of any of these events.
Right.
The King James can be misread, but the Greek syntax makes it very clear that when it says, even as they delivered them unto us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses. Who were from the beginning of eyewitnesses, referring to the they, not to the us? So he's received this from other people. This is some of the finest Greek in the New Testament. I usually tell my students that Luke Acts, the only Greek that's probably as good as Luke Acts is that of Hebrews. So it's very refined. It's purposefully classicizing sometimes. So we assume this author had a thorough Hellenistic education. Certainly has sympathy with Gentiles and is very interested in Gentiles. Although, and this may have something to do with the book of Acts, where it's laid out the gospel goes first to Jerusalem and Judea, Samaria, then the ends of the world. Luke is the gospel where Jesus never directly interacts with Gentiles. Whereas you have him interact with Gentiles a lot in Mark and some in Matthew. It's only Luke where it's this business, no Gentiles. And that may be because this author is planning to have the gospel extended in Acts. So, you know, the fact that he's a Greek writing for the Greeks is derived from nothing other than he writes really good Greek and he likes Gentile people, and Greeks are Gentiles. So, you know, once again, this is
pretty flimsy.
It's just that you just need to nuance. It's not that the usual observations don't work. It's just that they sometimes keep us from seeing other things in the text.
So it's great when you're first read or when you're in seminary, but as you become a more mature reader, I think you say, okay, well, let's nuance that a little bit. Let's be open to some other things. In terms of external evidence, Taylor had mentioned Marcion's canon. There's actually another earlier canon, well, not earlier, but another early canon called the Muratorian canon, which tells us Luke the physician wrote in his own name what he had been told about Jesus, though he had never seen the Lord in his flesh. So I think that's probably either he or Irenaeus are the first ones to say that the author is a guy named Luke. And then by cross-comparing that to three references in Paul to Luke as one of Paul's fellow workers. And I think the Colossian reference calls him the beloved physician. That's where we get this whole idea that he's a missionary companion of Paul and that he was a physician.
Right. Anything on that, Taylor?
In terms of authorship, no, I think that covers most of it. Maybe we can jump into, we talked about this opening statement where Luke identifies that he's writing to this person named Theophilus. And it's worth mentioning there that he, too, identifies pretty explicitly that he is using other sources and that he is attempting to put together a better version than the previous sources that had been available. So he's very consciously and explicitly rewriting the texts which had come before him. And I think he, like Matthew, would be very surprised that we were still reading Mark. They clearly didn't respect it enough to keep it as it was and wanted to expand and improve upon it. And so he certainly is using Mark. He's also using that other source that we've talked about, a collection of sayings of Jesus that we call Q. But he puts them in a totally different order. He doesn't have the five discourses that Matthew does. He seems to use them in some cases differently than Matthew as well. And he's also got a couple of other things that are unique to his gospel that aren't in the others. He does have a birth story that shares a few similarities with Matthew, but is largely entirely different, including he's the only source to say that that Jesus and John the Baptist are related.
Right.
And he also has two of the most famous parables of Jesus, the Good Samaritan and the Prodigal Son, which are only found in Luke.
Right.
So he seems to be drawing on some other sources that weren't available to any of the other gospel authors either.
While we're talking about sources, I just want to use kind of a case study, and this isn't to be critical of anyone in particular, but just to say how we need to be careful and nuanced in things. Taylor mentioned the unique Lucan infancy narrative and how it has things Matthew doesn't. You know, it has a particular focus on Mary, and it has stories about Mary that you would think no one would know about the confinement or the visitation or what she felt or what she did at the Annunciation. And so it's tempting to say, he must have talked to Mary. Well, he must have talked to someone or had a source that either knew family stories and traditions or had made them up.
Right.
You know, one of the things we do to try to identify the author of Luke Acts is we look at these famous we passages in Acts where we go from a third person narrative. Peter did this. Paul did this. We went over to Philippi. And so we say, wow, the author must have been with Paul during these things. Well, when Paul's arrested and imprisoned in Caesarea for 2 years, it's a we passage. And so Luke might have been free to travel around and see the places where these things happen or talk to people. He lists the different people he met, like Philip the evangelist and Manasseh and an original disciple. And James, by tradition, the stepbrother of Jesus. So, you know, he could have learned some of these stories from James, but we don't know that. So as tempting as it is to try to say, wow, this unique thing shows he knew Mary, is not something we can demonstrate from the text. It's simply an interesting and intriguing possibility that can be explained other ways.
Terrific. Any other characterizations of the Lucan narrative that important?
Well, I'm sorry that I have these trite little characterizations of things, but, you know, I'm a teacher, so we have to do it this way. You know, I tell my students that Mark is the Harry Potter gospel and it's a John Wayne Jesus. And we usually say that Matthew, you know, is this son of David interested in the messianic Jesus. I always call the Lucan Jesus the primary Jesus. He's the Jesus we grew up with that lovely picture of Harry Anderson of him sitting there with the children and the goat on the rope, you know. I don't know if you know this old saying. It was familiar in Protestant Sunday schools. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. I always correct and say, no, Jesus loves you, this you know, because the Gospel of Luke told you so. You know, this is the Jesus that doesn't tend to get angry. He's compassionate. He's giving, even in moments of great distress. All four Gospels mention that a disciple, and some it's Peter, cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest when Jesus is arrested in Gethsemane. Only Luke mentions that Jesus bothered to put the ear
back on. Yeah, that's right.
Only the Lucan Jesus, in the midst of the torture of crucifixion, takes the time to teach a first missionary discussion to the crucifixion victim. Only the Lucan Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And Luke's sensitivity to this aspect of, and I believe this about the historical Jesus, or the real Jesus, historical Jesus is another incident issue. His sensitivity and, I don't want to say softness, but his compassion, I think, also emerges in his depiction of other figures in the story. Taylor had mentioned that this characterization of the disciples as fumbling and unbelieving and confused, Matthew and Luke play it down. Well, Luke does more than play it down. He tries to portray people in a better light. So he knew full well, as Mark and Matthew did, that Peter, James, and John fell asleep three times in the Garden of Gethsemane. But he doesn't want to make a big deal of it. He just mentions it once. So he's a little bit more generous, and to use a term, Christian, in his treatment of figures than the other Gospels are.
Nice. Taylor, you don't have as many chances at Kalamazoo to give the primary or that example, right, for your people?
No, I love that one. I like that one. Yeah. Maybe we can end with Luke here, unless Eric wants to add something else. I loved everything that he says about Luke in that sense. And Luke has the reputation of sort of having a special concern for kindness for marginal members of society, the poor, women in some cases. There are aspects of the text that cut against that characterization too, but it is part of his reputation and part of the way that people have read that text for a long time.
Yeah, in fact, it starts very early, because one of the differences in the John the Baptist figure, John the Baptist figure, and even in the JST, there's this emphasis on the soldiers and behaving correctly and giving your cloaks to others. But I'm thinking of Jesus's quote of Isaiah. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me," this is in Luke 4, in the synagogue at Nazareth, "because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captive, recovering the sight of the blind, and set at liberty them that are bruised." This compassionate issue and the attention to – this is a great social gospel text, and it's hard when you're in a conservative venue to not be looked at strangely when you say this. But, you know, this is about the poor, the marginalized. We have – more women in this text. And Taylor's right, it's not a 100% consistent depiction. But for instance, Luke does this wonderful thing with gender pairs. I mean, I've seen it in the infancy narratives. Julie Smith has noticed it throughout the whole text.
Right.
That, you know, you have Zacharias and Elizabeth. You have Joseph and Mary. You have Simeon and Anna. And it continues. You have more healings of women in Luke than you have in the other Gospels. In fact, sometimes he almost seems to be consciously saying, okay, I've just healed a man with a withered hand. I better have a woman with osteoporosis in here too. I need to show that Jesus is interested in everyone. And the Gospel of Luke uses the noun save and the noun salvation and savior. Well, the verb save and the noun salvation and savior more than any other Gospel. Now, before we jump to too many conclusions, because, you know, Isaiah does use the term, the expression salvation, savior. This is a very prominent thing in Greco-Roman political speak. A temporal leader is a soter, a savior, if he rebuilds a city after an earthquake. You know, Augustus was known as a savior for restoring peace and prosperity after the civil wars. It may well be that in addition to the savior in the sense we think of it, a spiritual savior, that Luke was playing on this idea. People are always looking for people to rescue them from their situations. What they really need is Jesus.
Neat.
I love the way, we could just talk for hours and hours about this, but I love that Eric traces the compassion of Jesus to that opening citation. The first thing that Jesus says, actually, in the gospel is when he reads that passage from Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, about what the proclamation is going to be, and it is to liberate the captives, to make the blind see, and so on. And this understanding of the Messiah as a figure who doesn't just change the political situation, but really frees people in their individual circumstances too, is I think how it's significant that Luke starts with that quotation of Isaiah as a framing of what Jesus is going to do throughout the rest of the text. So.
Dan, if I can just say one more thing about structure and content before we move. Not that we have a favorite gospel, but if we did, of course, John, so we have to get to our buddy John. You know, we mentioned all these different sources he has, and Taylor's mentioned, you know, those parables that are unique to Luke. We have a lot. The structure's interesting because like Matthew, Luke has followed the basic structure of Mark, you know, just going to Jerusalem once. But there are some interesting omissions and additions. So, for instance, almost all of Mark 6:45 through 8:26 is missing in Luke. All that material is not there. It's called the great omission in some commentaries. And is it because he didn't like that material? Some people have pointed out that Luke doesn't like doublets. So you have a feeding of 5,000, a feeding of 4,000. Luke says one's enough. You have stilling the storm. You don't need to walk on water, too. So maybe some of this was removed to remove the doublets. But it may also have been, before we move to codices, it may have been scrolls are only so long. And he's going to have enough new material that he has to excise some. And so beginning in 951 through 1927, what would be called the road to Jerusalem in Mark, the Perean ministry we often call it Luke, a lot of the unique material in Luke is kind of dumped in that section. So I don't know that we can argue this. It's just interesting. Maybe Luke was writing and says, wow, look how much of my scroll I have. I have all this interesting stuff. I've got to cut this out for Mark. I better get this new stuff in fast. I don't know why he decided this. But it is an interesting little kind of aberration in the structure, this great omission and the concentration of unique material in the Perean ministry. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Taylor.
No, that's something I'll have to look into more. That's very interesting. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.